This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today with Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, who joins us on the line from Washington. Congressman, welcome back to you.
Great to be here, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And you know, we are a local show, but right now a lot of our hearts and minds are overseas. There are two big stories that we're following. You have Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in the halls of Congress earlier this week asking for aid and being told by Republican senators that he wasn't going to get it because of U.S. border policy, and we will get to that. But, Congressman, I want to begin with Morning Edition this morning, where James Elder, a spokesperson for UNICEF, said this.
We talk of indiscriminate. I would go a step further and talk of disregard for children, Steve. The safe zones that hundreds of thousands of people are being pushed to. Safe, yes, means free from bombardment. Legally safe also means the responsibility on Israel to make sure there is life-saving things there. Water, sanitation, and food. Those things are not just lacking, they are absent.
That's because UNICEF has declared Gaza the most dangerous place in the world for children. That's why he was on Morning Edition, as Israel continues its military campaign against Hamas there after Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th. So I want to start there with your reaction to UNICEF's assessment and what we just heard from James Elder, Congressman.
It's devastating. It's frightening. And there should be no innocent kids dying in this war, period. There are a lot of innocent kids killed on October 7th. That doesn't justify killing innocent kids in Gaza. I think it's easy in the midst of all the anger and divisiveness of this war to lose sight of the common goals. I mean, I fully support Israel in getting rid of Hamas. And anyone who wants to live peacefully in Gaza in the future should not want to live under a terrorist regime. The problem is how Israel is going about getting rid of Hamas. And I've been saying this for a long time now, that they're not learning the lessons of counterinsurgency campaigns, the lessons that we had to painfully learn ourselves in Iraq and Afghanistan, that you can't kill innocent civilians in the process of taking out terrorists because you just recruit more terrorists to the cause. That you have to have a plan for what comes next. You have to have a believable political outcome that both sides want, that the Israeli troops risking their lives can believe in, that the Palestinians caught up in the midst of this war can believe in. Because only if Palestinians have sovereignty and freedom and human rights will Israel be safe. And Israel will only be safe if it gets rid of the Hamas terrorists who have eliminating Israel in their charter. So we've got to find some common ground here to do the right thing. To get rid of Hamas, but to do so in a way that preserves innocent life.
You know, one of the reasons that I was looking forward to talking with you today, Congressman, is my experience with you has been that I can really talk to you. So as I listen to you, what I find myself wondering is it too late for that? You wrote a piece in October wanting us to learn from the failures of the war in Iraq that you participated in as a Marine. And then you wrote a piece in Time magazine wanting us to learn from the successes as well, all around the things you just laid out. And I hear you. And I also hear what we heard this morning and what we're hearing from the administration in Israel. And the way the whole world seems divided over what's happening in the Middle East. And I wonder if it's too late for that.
It's a fair question, but it's never too late to do the right thing. And if you think back to our experience in Iraq, we invaded in 2003. It wasn't really until the surge in 2007, where General Petraeus changed the strategy very consciously to a counterinsurgency campaign 4 years after that initial invasion, that we got it right. And it wasn't perfect, but it was a lot better. And you can go sit at an internet cafe in Baghdad today in relative peace.
What does getting it right mean?
It means that Israel ceases this bombing campaign that's just killing far too many people. And by the way, not yielding great results. I mean, when you look at the lists they have of senior Hamas leaders killed, they're not very long. I mean, we don't know exactly how many Hamas operatives have been killed, but even the Israelis admit that it's far fewer Hamas terrorists than civilians. So they need to change that strategy. They should have changed it 2 months ago. They need to change it today.
So when I think about leverage, Congressman, so I'm sort of imagining a continuum, right, that goes from unequivocal support of Israel in all ways and matters to the moment we heard earlier this week from President Biden speaking to donors in Washington, and I'm going to quote the president here, quote, "Israel's security can rest on the United States, but right now it has more than the United States. It has the European Union. It has Europe. It has most of the world supporting them. They're starting to lose that support by indiscriminate bombing that takes place," end quote. So a calling out. Then you have what Axios reported yesterday, where the U.S. is withholding licenses on some firearms over concerns about, and I'm going to do another quote here just because I want to get all my language right. So this is quote from Axios yesterday, quote, "Attacks by extremist Israeli settlers against Palestinian civilians in the occupied West Bank," two U.S. officials told Axios, end quote. So you get this continuum, right? Where is the leverage? Where on this continuum do you believe the United States should be right now, Congressman, given what you've just said to me?
Well, listen, I mean, I fervently support Israel. Don't tell me I'm not supporting Israel by telling them what they need to do to win. And that's where this sometimes gets confused. You know, sure, I've been critical of Israel's tactics, not critical of their goals, but critical of their tactics. But that's because I want them to succeed. Success doesn't look like what we're seeing in Gaza today.
So should you exercise any leverage, though? Do you understand my question?
Yeah.
Right? So if that's not where...
I was just getting to that.
Sorry. Okay, go.
You know, this is so often confused as a spectrum of do you support Israel or do you not? And what the United States should do, in my humble opinion, is what I'm doing, which is saying we absolutely support Israel, but we don't support them in a losing cause. I mean, imagine if Israel had commented on our war in Iraq in, say, 2005, when we were essentially inciting a civil war, and said, just have at it. Keep making the situation worse, America. That wouldn't have been good advice. Friends tell friends tough advice. They tell them the truth. And the truth, in my humble opinion, but an opinion formed over four tours fighting in the infantry in Iraq, is that Israel's tactics are not going to yield them a strategic victory. They actually risk yielding a strategic defeat. And if you believe in eliminating Hamas, as Israel does, but as so many leaders in the Arab world do as well, and there was a poll of Gazans just before October 7th that said 6 out of 10 do not support Hamas, actually even a little more than that. They don't want Hamas ruling their land. So if you support getting rid of Hamas, you should not want to see Israel mess this up. And they're messing it up right now at the cost of thousands of innocent lives.
So there is more that I want to talk to you about on other subjects. But before we let this go, Congressman, I'm going to ask one more question, sort of seeking to understand where the boundaries are in this that we're speaking about. And we're with Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton. So is there a point at which, understanding how clearly you are talking about your support of Israel's right to pursue a military response to the attack from Hamas on October 7th, is there a point, if Israel continues down this particular approach that you think is bad and ineffective, that you would support curbing in some way the U.S.'s military and financial support for Israel as it pursues this specific path? Is that an appropriate step at some point, Congressman?
Well, I don't think we should put restrictions on aid to Israel that we don't put on aid to other countries like Egypt, for example. But at the same time, because Israel is such an important ally in the United States, we've got to find a way for them to listen. You know, I've been more outspoken than the president about my calls for Netanyahu to step down. Some will say that that's inappropriate. I'm not an Israeli voter, You know, why should it be up to me to decide whether Netanyahu is in power? But I firmly believe that this policy, this strategy they have, that I fear will end up in their losing the war, is not going to change until Netanyahu is gone. That's an example of the kind of additional pressure that I think we could put on Israel to try to get this right.
Congressman, thank you for engaging me with that. There's obviously so much more that we could talk about, but we've also got Ukraine, which is sitting front and center with us now. Aid to Ukraine caught up in Congress. You have also called what's going on right now in the fight between Russia and Ukraine after Russia invaded in, I want to go back, February 2021 now. Do I have that right? 2021?
Yes.
Yeah, thank you. Sometimes time just sort of loses its meaning.
I know. It's
yeah.
There are too many wars going on, TCR.
Yes. And you've called it a stalemate. What does it mean for you as a Marine veteran? I know that word has meaning. What does it mean for you to call it a stalemate? And what does that mean needs to happen next?
It means that we need a new strategy. And that does not mean that we back off our support of Ukraine, but it means that we take a very hard look at what's working and what's not. Because somewhere around 350 people just like you and I, are dying every day in Ukraine that this war continues. And if they're dying in a stalemate, which means that there's literally nothing coming of this on either direction, no side can claim any progress or any victory, then that's an even worse waste of life than if one side was winning, I guess you could argue. So my point is that we need to continue supporting Ukraine for all the reasons we've laid out before. Freedom, democracy on the line. Putin's next stop will be a NATO country if we let him continue this march towards the West. That means American troops will be fighting and dying. Other autocrats like Xi Jinping in China are watching how we respond to Ukraine as they contemplate similar moves elsewhere in the globe. These are all reasons to support Ukraine. But just like we were talking with Israel about Israel, it shouldn't just be a blank check with no questions asked. We've been advising the Ukrainians on their strategy. When I met with officials from the Pentagon this week in a classified hearing, I press them to advise them differently, to change the strategy. They reported that, you know, Russia is managing to resupply itself with arms. Okay, then we need to tighten the sanctions. We need to examine what's worked with the sanctions, but what hasn't? How have they gotten through these loopholes and make changes? If something isn't working, you need to change it. That's what needs to happen here.
So briefly, understanding that was a classified hearing, were you satisfied with the response you got from the Pentagon?
I was satisfied that they intend to try. I was not satisfied with their progress to date.
So then you have the question of aid. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was at in Washington this week. We have talked about before the struggle going on between Republicans and Democrats over Ukrainian aid, with Republicans wanting to tie it to what they call reforms at the border. That is not what President Biden wants. Here's House Speaker Mike Johnson crystallizing the Republican stance on Ukraine aid in his comments to reporters Tuesday.
Our first condition on any national security supplemental spending package is about our own national security first. The border is an absolute catastrophe, and this is because of the policies of this White House and this administration.
So I know that the president is actively negotiating. I am mindful. One of the recent times we spoke, you referred to members of the GOP as basically being a threat to the U.S. national security. Do you believe that the actions that Republicans in Congress are taking in this way form a threat to national security?
I mean, I choose those words carefully, but sadly, yes. This is another example where they're putting politics ahead of national security. Every single day that goes by and we don't fund Ukraine, more Ukrainian kids are dying on the front line, and they risk American kids dying on the front lines in Europe in the near future if Putin is not stopped. So look, I'm someone who's been very candid about the fact that we need to address immigration and we need to tighten security at the border. By the way, we also need to have a pathway to citizenship for dreamers, like for kids who were brought here years ago by their parents through no fault of their own, have grown up in American communities and American schools and deserve a future in America that's not in limbo. Of course, Republicans won't agree to that. And that's why Democrats, including the president, want to tie border reforms to immigration reforms. That's a very sensible deal that should pass. But Republicans are the ones playing politics with national security by taking something totally unrelated, our support for Ukraine, our support for democracies, our support for NATO, and tying it to just one part of the immigration deal, just the part that they want.
Although there are Republicans who don't want that tie made. Last time we spoke with you, there was not yet a new Speaker of the House in place. And I've talked with you often on our air about the potential for reaching across the aisle. There are Republicans who don't want to put those two things together. With this new Speaker in place, is there a potential to de-link and move forward?
No, the problem is the new Speaker is afraid of his own members. Because here's the irony with all this, is usually you put difficult things together because you can't get them passed individually, right? But if you break this down, every Republican would vote for border security. Some Democrats would vote for that too. So that would pass the House. Every Democrat would vote for funding Ukraine. But a lot of Republicans, as you just said, they'd vote for funding Ukraine too. So that would pass the House. There'd be a lot of Democrats and Republicans who would vote for supporting Taiwan. That's the third component of the package. And the vast majority of the House would vote for funding Israel. So then you ask, okay, if this is hard to get done as a package, why don't you just have those four individual votes? And the reason is because Mike Johnson, our new speaker, is being pressured to not even bring the Ukraine bill to the floor by his own members. And rather than be a leader, rather than be an exemplar of democracy who just says, we're the United States of America, let's have a vote, he won't even bring these bills up individually to have those four votes. He's the one insisting on putting them together in a big package. And that's why we haven't done any of them yet.
Do they ever make it to the floor?
The stakes are so high, I have to believe that they will eventually. I have to believe that if not now, then sometime in January, we'll finally do the right thing. But it's sad. It is very sad that we can't do that. We managed to vote on deregulating whole milk in school lunches this week, Tiziana. What a great victory. It's not wrong. I voted for it, but come on. People are dying around the world.
So, I'm sorry, please.
I mean, it's just, this is not leadership from the Speaker of the House. This is not leadership from the Republican Party. This is not doing the right thing. Since when did the Republican Party become Putin's greatest gift? Since when did the Republican Party support Russia? But that's what they're doing.
So again, though, and I'm going to stop you there, and I'm going to ask you this before we, and then I promise I will lighten up for us for just a minute before we let you go. I want to ask you, and I'm hoping that there is a yes, that the exasperation I just heard in your voice, you hear in the voices of people in both parties, at least some voices of people. Okay.
I do. And I hear it publicly and privately from Democrats. And I hear it only privately from Republicans because they can't find the courage to say it publicly, to tell the truth. I heard it all that I had several conversations over the past few days just about this impeachment vote with moderate Republicans who said, we know there's no evidence. We know it's not the right thing.
Just for listeners, the vote to pursue an impeachment inquiry of President Biden. Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's right. And Republicans who have in the past said they won't vote for this because there's not evidence. And yet One of them said to me this week, you know, Seth, I just want it to go away. And I said, well, if you want it to go away, then don't vote for it. And he looked at me and he said, well, I guess that's true, but I don't know.
Did that person vote for it?
Yes. I tried. And he fundamentally agreed with me. But they're all scared. They're all scared of their own base.
Congressman, before we let you go, I want to bring it home. And as we go into a holiday season where I know we want to find a little moment to breathe it out. I'd like to find a little fun for just a minute, if you would give me permission.
I would love that, DCR. I would absolutely love that.
All right, so we're going to do two things. First, I understand that you are a Marine veteran, but I am curious if you paid attention to the Army-Navy game this past weekend, because I'm just kind of thinking maybe you did.
I mean, I paid attention a little bit, yeah.
So are you a football fan?
I'm a football fan.
And who does a Marine root for? This is my question. Who does a Marine root for in
Navy? Marines are supposed to.
Or do you just like be
Navy.
Like, oh, okay.
You know, we're technically part of the Department of the Navy. There's a joke in there I won't tell, but the point is that we're supposed to root for the Navy. And so sure, you know, I support the Navy.
Well, then I'm sorry for the loss. All right. And the last thing, this week, the Boston Globe magazine named Tea Riders its Bostonians of the Year. And knowing how you feel about transit, I was just dying to get your response to that.
I'm proud to be among them. But we got to do a lot better. And look, you know what? This has been in so many ways a depressing conversation. I'll admit that. It has been. But I keep doing this. I keep at it. Because there is so much we can do. There's so much we need to do around the world. We've talked so much about that this morning, but there's so much that we can do to make life better right at home in Boston. And I'm excited for 2024 because of all that work ahead of us.
Well, on that note, happy holidays to you. Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.